Good evening. My name's Ian Gordon. I'm from the Geography Department, and it's the Geography Department's pleasure this evening to welcome Saskia Sassen to talk with us. Saskia is Professor of Sociology in the University of Chicago and Centennial Professor of Urban Political Economy here, attached to the Geography Department. And these two jobs tell us some things about Saskia, and they don't tell us other things entirely about Saskia. I think the two jobs together suggest quite well where she stands in between the disciplines of the social sciences. They suggest something about her geographic range and mobility, but not that much. They understate the extent to which, in person as well as academically, she is truly global. And she is one of the foremost scholars of the globalization process. Over the past 15 years, which I've been aware of her work, the major themes of the work have involved, firstly, mobility of capital and labor on a global scale, and then increasingly cities, and especially the cities at the peak of the global system, and then increasingly the intersection of these in terms of migrants, the position of migrants at the bottom and the very top of global city markets. And currently she's working, I may touch on this evening, on questions about denationalization, not in the sense of what was done to our railways, but in the sense of the fading away of the nation state as a political and economic unit, as I understand it. Her major works, out of many that have been published and widely known, influential, provocative, over this period, include The Global City, about London, New York, Tokyo, which has just come out in its second updated edition after 10 years, I think, and Guests and Aliens, and as I said, she's currently working on a book on denationalization. These books have been translated into 12 languages, even more widely, in larger number of countries, they've been widely read. They've been disseminated through globe-trotting lecture tours. I think she's earned more air miles than Tony Blair over this period. And tonight we're very pleased to see her in London, where I think she's been for the whole week so far.
I'm a working girl, yes. I teach.
So tonight, immigration and citizenship in the global city, which in London at present is one of the most topical issues one could be talking about, given the explosive growth of immigration in the last few years and the last 12 years or so behind that. So, Saskia.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian, for that very nice introduction. My concern tonight is with a set of micro practices, micro transformations that are altering three basic institutions: citizenship, immigration, and the spaces for politics. Some of these micro-transformations are visible at the street level politics. Some require theory to be seen. And frankly, I don't know what some of us would do. We would be out of business if we couldn't count on theory. Globalization plays a crucial role in all of this. Insofar as globalization destabilizes existing formalized hierarchies of power, it creates openings for other kinds of actors to enter domains once exclusive to national states. These openings are of action, they're operational, they're also of speech, rhetorical. Probably the most familiar example to all of us is the entry of NGOs in international zones, international places, where before it was just national states that were active. A second clear example is, of course, the multinational corporation, which through some of the policies of globalization, privatization, deregulation, et cetera, has entered as a very significant actor into some of these spaces, and in fact is, one would say, except for some catastrophic outcomes like Enron and the Irish bank, is having a ball. And really, joie de vivre here becomes sort of joie de monnaie. And it is clearly a very powerful presence on the global landscape. There are a variety of other actors. They're less visible. And I often think of them as informal or not yet formalized political subjects. I also think of them as non-cosmopolitan actors. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I actually mean it in a positive sense. Non-cosmopolitan in the sense that they keep connected to questions of place, to questions of locality, and yet can operate increasingly with a growing global consciousness, which is partly a function of being in networks of multiple such localities. And sort of, if you want, the four building blocks for this talk that I'm giving you tonight are questions of citizenship, questions of immigration, the global city as a strategic space that makes a lot of this visible. And I should immediately clarify that there are more than three. I just ran out of effort and energy when I had only three in the book that I did on the global city. In my reading, there are about 40 cities around the world today that are global cities with an enormous amount of hierarchy in there. The fourth actor is this process of the destabilizing of these formalized political hierarchies. This destabilizing, at the heart of this destabilizing, that which is crucial for my analyses, is the fact that insofar as the national state partly withdraws, and it's often its own regulated withdrawal, from certain zones, and I'm thinking especially of cross-border, of international zones, where it was once the exclusive actor, in my view, and this is a bit sort of messy spatial thinking, if you want, in my view, these openings emerge, many of them left unattended. Microhistories are in the making as to who will occupy and seize those opportunities. But others are being filled in, as I said, with the multinational corporations, global markets in finance, both of which have assumed functions, regulatory functions, functions of power, functions of legitimation, which once were exclusive to national states. In many ways, the global financial markets have today the capability to force governments to execute economic policies that are the ones that they want. So in that sense, they have political power as well. We are talking about a political economy. But then there are all these other types of actors, which one could sort of group them into one big set and say the disadvantaged, those who don't have a lot of power, those who don't experience themselves necessarily as political subjects. And here I think of all kinds of possible actors. And I'll just give you a few just to create sort of a landscape, if you want, within which to understand the particular issues about immigration and citizenship that I want to get to. As I mentioned already, NGOs. The efforts by First Nation people to gain direct representation in international fora, not to have to go through national states. Certain aspects of the global human rights activism, certain aspects of the global environmental activism. Each of these, by the way, even as they're global, come out, are concerned with, have as their objective something that is very particular and very localized often. So it's that mix of being both a global actor but acting in terms of very specific issues in very specific types of places. Now, in my reading, there are these micro transformations that are happening with two, if you want, crucial institutions. One is citizenship, and the other is immigration. And together, they produce new elements in the spaces for politics. Now, I want to emphasize that what I'm talking about is something that is micro, that is partial. It is a zone of activity. It's a zone of transformation that actually requires a sort of archaeology of what's happening there. These are not things that are in your face. And secondly, I do think that it takes that bridge of theory to make them legible. And as soon as I've said that bridge of theory, I've also said that there is room for enormous disagreement. You may really not agree with me at all. But again, from where I sit, the little chair from which I look at all of this stuff, it seems to me that these micro transformations are indeed taking place. Now, let me start with citizenship then. In many ways, citizenship is a highly formalized institution. There is no doubt about that. And yet, I would argue, and I'm here with a bunch of other scholars, though they may have slightly different interpretations and way of looking at this, but I would argue that it is not a finished institution. I would argue that it is a far more embedded institution, and hence subject to change as that which it is embedded in changes, than the formal letter of the law suggests. And I mean, the image that I like to use is that citizenship, while highly formalized, is pregnant. And we don't know the kinds of babies it will deliver. Now, let me mention a few indicators that sort of get at some of this, what I mean by not finished. I think that one of the most dramatic events is what happened in the United States in the 1960s, the civil sort of liberty struggles, when we actually incorporated formal changes that extended rights of citizenship to sectors of the population which before did not have them. That, to me, is not only an enormously significant event on its own terms, it also is enormously significant because it signals the potential, at least, for more changes to come. Second indicator of this sort of unfinished quality, if you want, of citizenship is the fact of dual nationality. In the last 5 years, more and more countries have accepted dual nationality and dual citizenship. More people than ever before today have dual nationality. This creates, formally speaking, inside that highly formalized institution, a change. And the change is formal. In other words, it can accommodate. The institution is unfinished in that sense. It is one interpretation, one interpretive move, if you want, because it still can accommodate a formal change. And the change can be named a shift in citizenship from exclusive allegiance to one state to effective allegiance, in this case, two states. And it is quite possible that, in fact, in some future, we will have multiple nationalities. So again, for me, these are indications of unfinished business. Now, I say unfinished business because I am very interested in understanding what are the possibilities of changes in that institution that in a way make for a better world. You know, the substantive rationality that guides this theorization that I'm engaged in really has to do with using that enormously powerful institution that citizenship is to think about a possibility of enabling those who are not necessarily today enabled. Now, you know, there is a certain romanticism and idealism about it, but there is also that technical sort of reading, if you want, of these transformations that are occurring. Now, let me move to immigration. Migration is actually, unlike citizenship, which is a highly formalized institution, immigration is really a messy term. We use it in a thousand ways. It is a term that is so charged with historical content, with immediate content as you walk through the streets of London, that we sort of stop thinking about what it means. What is immigration? And I wanted to sort of start. Now, I have a bit of visual elements. Now, visual for me means simply more words, by the way. So that is sort of, you know, my... So you get words twice, which does not necessarily ensure greater clarity. But let's just start with looking at how immigration policy produces the subject of the immigrant. And this holds, basically, for the North Atlantic. In Japan, it is a bit different, but unsurprisingly, actually, not that different. Unsurprisingly similar, in a way. Now, the first point to comment is that immigration is treat it as an autonomous sphere, as if it's somehow, and that then leads into the second point here, that it is produced by the immigrants themselves. The wars that we fight, whether it is in Bosnia, in Kosovo, in Afghanistan, that might produce these flows, somehow are not entered into the picture. Multinational corporations setting up facilities which create bridges, if you want, with the countries of origin don't enter into the picture because of that first assumption. And I must say that even critical immigration scholars don't focus. It's a bit taken as a given. But because of that first assumption that it's treated as an autonomous sphere, the second one flows very easily. In other words, the immigrants produce the process of immigration. The third point then, in turn, flows from the preceding one, which is that the responsibility, the burden of proof, lies on the immigrant to produce the papers, the documents, whatever, that warrant her being taken in by this generous or not so generous country. Now, there is another argument to be made, and that is that what we call immigration is actually a process that, moreover, we think of as beginning at our border, that is actually on a much bigger loop, where that moment when the immigrant arrives at the border, whether the border is a consulate in the sending country or whether the immigrant is, you know, arriving literally at the border, like at an airport, that is a loop that actually starts much earlier. And it might start, in the case of the United States, with decisions taken in the Pentagon. Who knows what the equivalent is in the UK? And it might start it might also start in the corporate boardrooms in New York. And that what we define experience and code as this immigrant producing this process of immigration is actually an outcome of an earlier process. Now, if I want to bring in that whole loop, the question of the formal conditions under which immigrants are accepted and what the formal subject of the immigrant is changes dramatically. The immigrant is no longer simply pleading for the generosity, etc. The immigrant might actually be acting out the conclusion of a process that was started by other actors. And so one of the issues for me has been, this is sort of a side note, is to take into account the multiple actors that actually constitute this process of migration. Now, as I put that at that bottom line there, there is a partial exception, and that is war, especially international war refugees. The refugees in most countries in Europe are under a legal regime that acknowledges responsibility by the receiving government of producing the refugee flow, at least in part. What I'm arguing is that when it comes to economic migrants, we should actually begin to work in that direction as well. There is enormous evidence. It's much messier than in the case of refugees. But the key point here is that the subject of the immigrant is produced in a certain way, and the way in which it is produced is partial and representative of a particular optic on what is happening. The other part of how the immigrant as a subject is produced is that it is produced as a racialized subject. And here, Europe's history, I did a lot of research and reading about the 1800s and the 1700s in Europe. There were lots of migrations. Most of these people came from regions that were the same as where they went to, more or less, same phenotype, same religion, often similar languages. And yet, this immigrant, who was not really an immigrant, in a way often was a migrant, was produced as a racialized subject, as the other. In the United States, we have the case of the Irish, right, which more or less looked like, et cetera, also produced as if they were, when you read the descriptions, it's extraordinary. It's the same descriptions that are today used to describe, for instance, people of color. So a real racializing, it does not have to do with race. It is a racializing dynamic. Now, today, the reason I mention this is that the contemporary discourse whether you're in France, in the Netherlands, in the UK, in the United States, focuses precisely on these differences. Today, we're dealing very often with immigrants who are coming from different cultures, with different religions, with different phenotypes, etc., etc. So today, there is a persuasiveness about the argument, often put in terms of cultural distance, which, if you look at the past, destabilizes that persuasiveness. And my argument is that we need to look at the past when the phenotype was the same and the religion and the culture, in a way, to understand that today's logic is deeply flawed. It's a stand-in logic for what is ultimately, again, a racializing argument. And a very interesting case is, which is rampant today, as you know, your government, the government of the UK has decided to bring in, you know, if you have either human or that other kind of capital, in other words, you have money, to bring in people who are highly educated, highly skilled, to facilitate. So they are considered foreign professionals. They are not considered immigrants. Whereas low-wage workers, the nannies, the maids, the janitors, they are immigrants. What I'm trying to do here clearly is to sort of destabilize the subject that the immigrant is by both looking at history and looking today at these differences. I can't remember what comes next. Let's just keep here. Now, I want to go on with this question of immigration and to suggest that as with citizenship, today there are micro events, micro transformations, which actually destabilized the kind of subject that I've been describing. And let me just mention a few elements. And again, these elements very often become visible in the context, that kind of political space that the global city is. But among these are, for instance, something that I like to call unauthorized yet recognized. We know from multiple little studies and some big studies that immigrants, say undocumented immigrants, unauthorized immigrants, who live for a very long time in a community with mostly natives, right? They become part of that community. And one legal scholar has described this as an informal social contract. So they are, yes, undocumented, unregistered, unauthorized. Nonetheless, they become part, not of a formal social contract, but of an informal social contract. But that already destabilizes both the notion of social contract, I would argue, and the notion of the undocumented as a hermetic condition. You are or you're not. You're either undocumented or you're not undocumented. There is something that is happening that, again, we can think of as destabilizing that subject. A second issue is the question of human rights, that human rights do attach to undocumented immigrants, unauthorized immigrants. And in fact, I don't know how many of you saw the decision. It just came out 2 days ago by the European Court of Human Rights. And it's a first in many, many things. The court held Belgium guilty for the collective expulsion of about 74, I can't remember the precise number, Roma people from Slovakia who were seeking asylum in Belgium. Now, this is a first. This is a first to invoke this issue of collective expulsion. Now, give the court some time, right? Because, I mean, it hasn't had that much time yet, perhaps. But right now, and actually, I wanted to read it to you because it's a first of so many things that I want to give it right to you if I find it. I don't seem to have. Yes. So it's the first ever by the court in a case involving collective expulsion of Roma people. It's also a first ever that the court found a violation of that particular article. It's Article 4 in Protocol 4. You don't need to remember that. That bans the collective expulsion of aliens. Now, I don't know if you understand how significant this is, because this puts a lot of state activity, which is in the business of de facto collective expulsion, though not formally, because each case is supposedly individually attended to, etc. And it's also a first ever that the court has found a Western European country, supposedly the good guys, right, in violation of the convention of human rights, the European Convention, where Roma rights are involved. Now, as you well know, Roma people, in whatever incarnation, you know, the travelers, whatever, that they have found in the European space, have been the subject of a lot of, you know, not so kosher treatment, let's say. And it also, actually, this case also breaks new ground in terms of the burden of proof. Again, what I want to pull out of this is the fact that it destabilizes, in this case, the subject that is the asylum seeker. Now, with immigration, going on just a bit, a very interesting issue, which plays a bit in your country as well, is a whole series of decisions in courts in the United States where undocumented workers have gone to court to sue their employers to claim that their employers had not paid their wages. A whole set of judges adjudicated in favor of these undocumented immigrants. Things have changed, by the way. It's no longer as good as it was, you know, as these cases suggest. What does this do? This actually produces out of this illegal immigrant a subject that is a partial, but it is, legal persona. And again, I would like to argue, I would like to interpret that as destabilizing the subject of the illegal immigrant. These are, I repeat, micro destabilizations, but they create blurry edges, fuzzy edges. So if you put together the notion of citizenship as an unfinished institution and immigration as a wobbly institution, fuzzy edges, then these openings that I'm talking about sort of come out, if you want, almost synergistically of that kind of setting. Now, I think I just, before I move on to talk about the space, this question of new political spaces, I should mention that there is a lot of renationalizing in immigration policy. The United States has taken away rights from immigrants. Your country, I don't know if anybody saw, I assume this is absolutely priority reading, your Home Secretary Blunkett just came out with a white paper on immigration entitled, what is it, Safe Borders, something like that. The title sounds great, which one could really interpret as a comprehensive set of measures to deliver an improperly managed, racist, and intimidating immigration system. So in the United States, I always like to say that immigration sort of policy people seem slightly managerially challenged. There are a few mistakes they have ever avoided. So I want to emphasize that the context is one of struggle, of contestation, of combat. These are not actually, you know, rosy sort of scenarios. I have to do an archaeology of the legal formal institution and detect where there are little holes, little openings, fuzzy edges, to read the story that I'm telling you, to read these destabilizing tendencies. And that is why I emphasized at the beginning that what my concern is here are these micro practices, these micro alterations. Now, one cannot help, or I cannot help, but then remember something that now, for those of you in the know, that a rapper in New York recently called the power of the pretzel. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but that deep political thinker, Bush, he almost killed himself, literally. I mean, he came out with wounds, etc., because he swallowed a pretzel. So it's like a vignette, you know, but it is an image. We can't disregard the micro, the little, that which is not represented as power. Now, let me then move on to this question of the space of the global city. Now, as I said, there are many more than the three that I studied. In my estimation, etc., there is a network of 40 global cities around the world. And it is a space for the manage. It's a space of power. It's a space for the management of global operations of firms and markets. Enormous hierarchy. What I describe here to you is, I believe, something that gets enacted mostly in the global cities of the North, in the global North, and also in cities that may not necessarily be global cities. What the global city brings is a strategic quality to these political projects that I'm talking about. It is a strategic site for the operations of global corporate capital. And it is also a space where a diversity, a multiplicity of people from all over the world are coming together in ways that would never happen in most of the hometowns or home villages from where they came, whether they are Europeans, Africans, Asians, etc. So in that sense, it becomes a very special kind of site, and I would say also strategic, but in that other way, in that it creates an almost unique set of possibilities of interactivity, connectivity, presence to each other among people who are basically, I'm really concerned here with the disadvantaged, with those who lack power, not with the glamorous, you know, foreign professionals. I'm interested in those who lack power. So in that sense, the global city for me is a site that where the strategic operations of both of these actors, global corporate capital, political, economic, strategic operations, and this mix of disadvantaged actors, political projects, find, you know, the strategic place, if you want, for the enactment of these activities. Now, I should also quickly clarify that two things. One is that when I speak about the global city, it is not a descriptive term. It's not that it's the whole city. I think a city like London, a city like New York, a city like Sao Paulo, Bombay, Sydney, Seoul, I don't mean to offend anybody by not mentioning your city. Sometimes when I go around the world talking, I have to really watch out. Make sure you mention all those cities. Each of them is multiple cities. Each of them contains a multiplicity of, you know, urban dynamics, etc. The global city is one particular kind of dynamic, and I just want, it's a complex one, it's a dominant one, it has enormous shadow effects, it shapes, it inscribes, it demolishes, it eliminates, it evicts. We're talking power. Both on both sides, I mean, that is, I think, part of my argument. Now, but I want to just, having said this, that the global city is strategic because it is a site where global corporate capital finds, you know, some of its key resources and conditionalities, and it is this incredibly mixed people environment. But let's just think city, but it has to be big, messy city, not suburb, not controlled environment, not the idealized city of planners, at least some of the planners that I adore and I know, who want it all very, very neat. I'm not talking about that kind of a city. I'm talking about a city that is slightly anarchic, quite messy, and not totally controlled, okay? So that for me is city-ness, the unexpected, et cetera, et cetera. Now think of the space of the city as a space for politics compared to the space of the national as a space for politics. The space of the national is an enormously significant space for politics. We as citizens should, I think, be far more active in it. But it is a highly formalized space. It is, in many ways, an incredibly exclusionary space. We have the vote, which we should use much more and much better. And secondly, we can take our states to court. As you know, in most European countries, that right has now been constitutionalized. It used to be by statute, which is sort of a weak regime. Now it is constitutionalized. And I would think, for instance, that what's happening now around these issues of civil liberties after, certainly in the United States, after September 11, that should lead to a variety of lawsuits. I mean, we're seeing some very disturbing trends there. But it is, in the end, powerful as it is, powerful as the instrumentalities are that we as citizens can use, it is exclusionary. You've got to be a citizen. And in many ways, we also know that the income issue plays in. The statistics show over and over again that lower income people seem to be less likely to believe that their vote will make a difference. So it's a problematic space. It's also an imperfect and perhaps one might say unfinished. I like to think of it that way. I think there is much more that we can do. And by the way, Ian, I really don't think that the state, the national state, is, what did you say, on the wane. I think the national, but it's a profoundly altered state. But and that is why I want to emphasize that I think that the space of national politics is enormously important, and we should grab it, we should do much more with it, etc. But then think of the space of the city as a space for politics. An enormous diversity of close to the ground, concrete, and this is crucial for my argument, a lot of informal politics, whether street-level politics or other kinds of informal politics. The space of the city makes possible an enormous variety of political engagements that do not have to run through formal institutions. I mean, they also run through formal institutions. But if you think about the brawls, for instance, that can happen in local community boards, for instance, you know, where people really get to fight each other on this or that, often terribly crucial issues like that lamppost, you know, on that corner, do we cut down that tree? No matter. But it is close to the ground. It's concrete. It's specific. For me, the crucial issue is that it can accommodate the political activities, the political projects of a whole variety of actors who may not be formal citizens, who may, even if they're citizens, feel that they are not really part of the system. And here another, before I mention this category that I use, which is unauthorized yet recognized, and I talked about the undocumented immigrant and the informal social contracts, I have another category that I like to use, which is authorized but unrecognized, which is, in a way, it spells out discrimination. Now, this is the case for a lot of women, for a lot of blacks, etc., different, you know, kinds of subjects in different parts of the world. But the space of the city enables these authorized yet unrecognized subjects to engage in politics. Think of neighborhood associations. Think of the variety of ways in which women will get involved in politics, you know, at that very local level. Think of the ways in which undocumented immigrants, again, because they're such a sharp, sort of defined subject, if you want, can get engaged in demonstrations against police brutality, claims for the rights of the homeless. Think of street-level politics as this incredible mixity of these kinds of ultimately informal, or at least not yet formalized, types of politics. Now, crucial issue for me, and here again, here is where interpretation enters the picture, because you know you don't have a definitive proof on these kinds of subjects here. But it seems to me that one of the dynamics that is taking place here is the forging of new political subjects. And these are political subjects that in a way also go beyond questions of the politics of culture, multiculturalism, etc. The mixity is such, the political projects are such, that something else is happening. That something else is also happening, I think, because of the new network technologies. And here I'm thinking especially about the public access internet. I want to make a big footnote, and yes, it is true that digital divides exist, access is an issue, but you know, actually, you go to a place like Bombay, you go to a place like Lima, and you see these little, they are like telephone booths, where for less than the price of a telephone call, people, I mean, you can't be totally destitute, clearly, but people can connect. The connectivity question is more complex than the digital divide argument and image suggests. But the point here that I'm trying to make is that given these new network technologies and given the greater possibilities for connectivity than many of us think are there, actually, something else happens. And that is that these localized actors, these often place-bound organizations, engaged in multiple very partial, and that's why I said non-cosmopolitan politics, can actually connect with other such efforts around the world and can begin to think themselves in a slightly different way. Sort of an emergent globalized, I mean, you know, it's one way of putting it, I'm trying to capture it. I think it's much less defined than that. The subjectivity is not a global subjectivity, but it is a sense of being part of networks where other such organizations with similar efforts are actually engaging, you know, around the world. And my favorite example here is a case of Spark, which some of you may know. Slum-dwelling women in Bombay who decided to organize for housing, housing that meant a localized event in Bombay. It also meant engaging the local government. They found a good formula. They communicated with women in Jakarta, in Taipei, in Seoul, in Bangkok, created an Asian network. The network then jumped to Johannesburg. We're talking largely disadvantaged and very resource poor individuals and organizations. Johannesburg, lots of slum dwelling people there, women. Quito, you know, and it has spread. Now, they don't gain money. They don't gain power in some sort of immediate sense from being part of this global network. But they gain something. And I think the something is a mix of clout, the awareness that they are part of this network, the awareness vis-a-vis whom they're negotiating with, mostly their local governments, right, for housing, that that local government knows that they're part of a network. And of course, they also got invitations from the World Bank and the Ford Foundation, you know, that always goes with these wonderful initiatives. But something happens. And here I think that globalization has these enabling sides also attached to them. Yes, it is about power, an enormous amount of power. But by destabilizing existing hierarchies, existing formalized hierarchies of power, and because global corporate capital doesn't want to seize all grounds, because some grounds are of zero interest, these openings that I mentioned at the beginning, both of action and of speech, operational and rhetorical, are actually part of the configuration. We're also dealing to some extent, or I'm talking about people who have not necessarily experienced themselves as comfortably sort of part of the national collectivity, either because they're human rights activists or environmental activists, because they're minorities whom the state has not, you know, treated equally. Again, coming back to citizenship as an unfinished project, the kinds of changes that are still happening, women who may be involved in a feminist transnational project, et cetera, et cetera. The second comment that I wanted to make here is that these issues that I'm talking about are made legible to some extent in the space of the city, particularly the large city, sharply the global city, because of all these multiple presences. But there are other sites where these dynamics are also operative. And here I mention, for instance, human rights, you know, institutional sites. And in my current research, I'm doing a lot of work on that. Now, I want to return to citizenship in this context and make an argument that the global city, the space of the city as a space for politics, also makes legible a crucial issue in my reading. Now again, it's micro, okay? And that is that we have, what we have experienced, what we have inherited, in a way, unthinkingly, as a unitary category, citizenship. Either a citizen or you're not a citizen. It's actually an amalgamation of elements, some of which inevitably associated with the national state, a formal bundle of rights that, forget it, it's a national state that grants them, that ensures them, that protects them, et cetera, et cetera. But then there are other elements in this category. What I'm doing here analytically is the same as what I did with the undocumented immigrant. Destabilize that kind of formalized subject, i.e. the illegal immigrant, or in this case, the citizen. And so what you can do is you can actually theoretically unbundle, but partly because it's made legible in the space of the city, this category of citizenship and see that, yes, there are the formal rights, but there are also citizenship practices that can be enacted by non-citizens. The daily life in a city, certain political demonstrations, you know, citizenship practices. I also think, by the way, that the anti-globalization network, you know, I mean, you have to have the money to buy the ticket and you have to get the visa and all of that. But basically, these are non-citizens, you know, going to Melbourne, to Genoa, to Quebec, to Prague, etc., doing their stuff as citizens, because most of them are not, you know, highly destructive, like the Genoa police tried to tell us. But they're engaging in citizenship practices. They're in a zone that is not their national territory. They're foreigners, they're tourists. They're engaging in citizenship practices. So there is a sense, and this again is connected to globalization. It is a response to globalization. But, you know, again, my favorite sign at the first of these at Seattle of the anti-globalization demonstrators was, of course, Worldwide Coalition Against Globalization. I mean, this is very much. And I must tell you, I just came back from Porto Alegre, the World Social Forum. I urge everybody to go there next year, 60,000 people, and held as a counterpart to the World Economic Forum, you know, in New York. The World Economic Forum has at its heart, I mean, I'm just quickly describing, just in case some of you have not heard of it, but at its heart, 1,000 CEOs of the largest corporations in the world. And for entertainment, they trot in presidents and prime ministers and central bankers and a few academics, etc. So the World Social Forum invents itself last year, today, this year was the second time, as a counter to the World Economic Forum. And the first, every day, I mean, 60,000 people, it's not like you know exactly what is happening. But the first day, the theme that sort of, you know, floated up, that everybody was beginning to talk, I don't know if everybody, but it was sort of in the air, was the notion of recovering globalization from the neoliberal corporate appropriation. I mean, we often use globality, right, to distinguish that. And the notion that what was happening in Porto Alegre, this is in the south of Brazil, by the way, it's a very long trip, what was happening in Porto Alegre in the World Social Forum was far more global than what was happening at the World Economic Forum in New York, which was seen as sort of a party of elites, a few elites, mind you, not even all. So I found it very interesting that this theme of recovering globalization, you know, it's like an evolution from this thing of Worldwide Coalition Against Globalization. And the second day, the theme that began to float up was the rights to the city. Because, you know, once you're operating in a certain sort of globalized network of very particular organizations that are largely involved with very localized projects, the city is that space that can articulate that localized effort with that global network of multiple such localized efforts. And in this sense, I think of this as a non-cosmopolitan form of the global. And again, I don't mean non-cosmopolitan the way the fancy cosmopolitans would think. I realize I am one of the fancy cosmopolitans. I know that. I mean, I am totally aware of this. And that's, I say it with, not with shame, objectively, right? A bit of shame. But the cosmopolitans would say, you know, non-cosmopolitan is bad. Is narrow. I am trying to use the term non-cosmopolitan precisely to capture those efforts that are localized, but which are their own form of global. They are the resource-poor individuals and the resource-poor organizations, which have very particular subjects. I want housing. I want public health facilities. I want, etc. The human rights activists, in many ways, are non-cosmopolitan activists. The environmentalists, they are concerned with particular. The environmentalists, the favorite example is, of course, that gray owl in that particular tree, right? I mean, that's a non-cosmopolitan. That doesn't make it bad. So I think, again, for me, to recover a non-cosmopolitan form of global consciousness is a very attractive counter to the cosmopolitan. You know, we need both, I think, frankly. So continuing now with this question, so the other issue that comes out of all of this is the possibility of citizenship identities that can be transnational, you know, not totally localized, et cetera, et cetera. These are all micro aspects. Again, as I said, they are at the edges. You know, they're not at the heart of all of this. It means that mostly when I think of a citizen, I think of an entity that is multiple subjects. What I'm talking about is the possibility that some of the subjects that constitute that citizen can actually begin to develop these transnational identities. That does not mean the elimination of a sense of the national. And finally, this question of locations for citizenship. And here I have sort of an interesting set of arguments against the notion that post-national citizenship is the only version here, something that is outside the national. I think, on the contrary, that at the sub-national, and here the city is crucial, we can also see some of these, what I would then think of as denationalized forms of citizenship that are centered in concrete, etc., efforts. Now, in a way, let's see, I have something else here. I just want to sort of return to this particular point. Global cities, then, can be thought of as these strategic sites for new types of political practices. The important point is that it's a variety of issues. It's multivalent. It's not all good, it's not all bad. They are strategic for the emergence of multinational corporations as subjects in a way that they were not 20 years ago. This is a crucial part of the story. And also my sort of informal, non-cosmopolitan political subjects. In the end, as a political space, you could say that cities are informal, inclusive, and flexible. Now, they're also the site where national political power instantiates. So, again, this is one partial reading of what happens in the space of the city. One way of interpreting this is as a partial denationalizing, but again, it's partial, it's micro, of the space that these cities represent. I want to conclude by saying that, in a way, what I've been talking about is the forging of a new type of political subject that is a partial subject, whose existence and whose emergence, if you want, is made legible in the space of the city, particularly the large city, but it's not necessarily produced by the city. I mean, I think that there is a lot of both empirical research and theorization to be done there. There is an archaeology, you know, to what extent is the city actually truly enabling this, and is this an exclusive event of the city? Or is it that we can see it, that the city makes these kinds of changes legible? Those are all questions that we need to sort of keep on researching in many ways. Secondly, this is not meant to be there, by the way. I just have to get out of this. I don't want to do it right now. Secondly, this notion of a global politics that is a politics of places with one big difference, places that are located on global networks. This is an infrastructure for, I think, global civil society, et cetera, et cetera. But what is most important to me in the light of what I was talking about today is that this form of globalization enables those without resources, those who are poor, those who don't have the option to think themselves cosmopolitans, to become part of what is ultimately an emergent global civil society, an emergent global consciousness, and in that sense, a new type of political subject. Thank you very much. Shall I stay here?
Right. Thank you very much, Saskia. That was very stimulating. We'd now move to the second stage of this three-stage event. Perhaps I can just say the third stage will be a reception in the staff dining room to which all are welcome.
You're all invited.
Absolutely. So this is an event which is progressively destabilizing, I think. And, the opportunity now to clarify or destabilize the destabilization. There are some microphones around, so if you could put your hand up when you want to raise a question or make a point, then the microphone can be brought to you. The acoustics in this room are one-sided. All the power is up here until you get the microphone.
You seem to be quite excited by the recent ECHR case against Belgium. But given the fact, on the one hand, that Western civilization are mostly based on democracy and the rule of law, and the fact, on the other hand, almost invariably, immigration law on a national level are made by citizens of Western countries, but are imposed on or applied, applicable to foreign immigrants. Where do you think this whole law business will lead us to? Thank you.
Well, I mean, I'm doing a lot of, in this project that I've been at for 7 years on governance and accountability, I have had to pay a lot of attention to three aspects of the law. One is law as jurisprudence, you know, elaborate, complex, with high aspirations, with norms, normativity, etc. The other one is law as the production of legalities that are useful to those who have the power to incentivize the system to produce these legalities. In other words, low level, etc. And that can happen in legislatures, in court decisions. That can also happen in increasingly privatized regulatory systems. So this is a very... The third one, which is what I mostly was talking about today, how even that which is formalized as a legal condition, right? The citizen, the undocumented immigrant. I mean, that is a legal condition in the sense that it's illegal. That it's about illegality. Our unfinished projects are subject to change and transformation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think of the law, and this is a whole new scholarship that is happening, which really looks, for all I know, you are a legal scholar, that looks at law as a constructed event. And here again, I think that globalization, by destabilizing existing arrangements, etc., by bringing in a lot of innovation, often, makes legible some of these features of the constructed quality of the law. And I mean, this really requires a kind of archaeology. You have to move into very specific features of a legal system. You can't just take it at that very general level. So that's one thing. Now, there seem to be two parts to your question, because the first one you started out by saying Western countries. Now, Western countries, you may have been sort of trying to name a kind of country where this question of the law, is formalized law, is a much bigger factor than maybe in some other parts of the world, where you have custom as a crucial way of organizing events. But I do think that precisely because these Western countries are so sort of obsessed with questions of the rule of law and everything gets filtered through this, and of course sometimes it becomes ridiculous what happens, right? That it is also a very sort of nice, what I like to think of, natural experiment situation, which we social scientists are always desperate to find, but there are not many. To look at some of these issues, precisely because these strictures and the formality of it all. So in that sense, it's not that I'm so enthusiastic about the European Court. You know, I just was naming, it's a first for this, it's a first for that. I mean, I do think, again, these are micro events. My experience is, of course, that some of these micro trajectories might go somewhere and others don't go anywhere. You know, and so it's a question of seeing what happens. Am I answering your question? We can continue at the reception. I could say, you know, a lot more. Yes. You want to speak without the microphone since they're not seeing you? There is somebody in the back? Oh, okay.
Am I going to speak? Okay. I have a question which I think I won't put, but what I will ask, well, will just say is, perhaps, are you not being, let's put it like this, a trifle optimistic, to put it mildly, I mean extremely optimistic, when you fairly happily and glibly talk about the possibility of the disadvantaged communicating with each other. In the slums of India that I know, over 50% of the people, well over 50% of the people, can't read or write, not even their name. They certainly can't read or write English for the internet to pop into the local internet cafe, even though they exist.
Yeah. Okay, this is a question that a comment that I get a lot, and let me just take it very, very seriously. What you said is a very shared view. First, you don't have to know English to access the internet. This is something that people think. It's not correct. In Japan, have you ever been in... It's I know, but I'm also talking about, I'm talking about Lima. And hey, you do it with Spanish. There is much more use nowadays of all these other languages, precisely because they can connect, sort of a diasporic, globalized network emerges. So that is one issue. Secondly, about India, there are very significant organizations of women. You can do politics, even if you don't know how to read and write. And I do think that theorist made enormously significant contributions, which went beyond what I just said. I just said, I know about India. There are these two very big organizations, right, that connect enormous numbers of women throughout. They're doing politics. Now, what Freire adds to this is that even if you don't know how to read and write, and there are a lot of people in Latin America, of course, you have knowledge. So we can't, this is also comes back to the question of the law. We in the West are obsessed with certain mediating elements, which I think I do not want to rob from a lot of poor organizations and people the possibility of engaging in politics. And I do not want to rob from them the possibility of actually engaging in a politics of the global. Under these kinds of conditions, and that was why Porto Alegre was extraordinary, because there was a lot of that, in a sense of energy. Am I an optimist? Oh, yes, I am an optimist. I know that. I have organized immigrants in the United States. I've been on picket lines of Salvadoran undocumented who are more active in terms of, asking for things about their workplaces, etc., than legal citizens. I mean, than citizens or legal immigrants. Yes, I'm an optimist. But then at this point is when I like to make the following comment. No formal system, I'm talking big, formal system of power has lasted forever, except perhaps the Catholic Church. I will acknowledge that. Secondly, over the last 100 years, no big formalized system of power has been brought down by an equally big formalized system of power. There was a time when the French Empire fought the English Empire, the Portuguese Empire, etc. You had sort of it. But that is not the history, really, the more recent history. How did the Soviet Union, how was it brought down? How did Marcos in Philippine, how was he brought down? How were the dictatorships in Latin America brought down? They were not brought down by another big power. They were brought down by a variety of things, by that destabilized, created, hollows, et cetera, hollowness. There is a reading of history. I mean, the problem is that the history you learn in school is the history of the generals and the armies and and the United States certainly conducts itself as, but there is another history to be written, and I do think that Negri and Hart, when they talk about the multitude, I mean, for me, that's a bit too general as a statement. I prefer my far more nailed down, if you want, place-specific, localized projects. There is another history in the making. Now, I emphasize, these are micro-practices, micro-alterations. They're not the big picture. But those micro-practices, those micro-alterations exist. Another example, Global Forest Watch, does anybody know that? Global Forest Watch is a global network that involves often very poor, because we're talking about deep in the forests, populations that are functioning as observers, as watchdogs against logging companies, etc. They hook into, you know, the internet and communicate to a centralized entity about what's happening. This is working. Now, these are all partial and micro projects, but my effort is to make visible this minor, admittedly, set of practices, histories, and projects. I think the big stuff, I also work on global finance, so you know, it's not like I'm, the big stuff is dominant, et cetera, et cetera. But there is all of this other stuff. And again, when you look at history, it is interesting to see how systems have been brought down. You know, and so, anyhow, I'm trying to demote big formalized powers in this. Yes. Did you have a question?
There's a guy here. Yeah.
Yes, you used the term non-cosmopolitan, was it networks or subjects?
Subjects.
Yes, to describe the opposite of activists traveling around the world to various conferences and protests, that is to describe people who build solidarity networks where they are.
No, they're not. That not necessarily. It's more a more elite situation that I'm contrasting. The cosmopolites, you know,
right?
Than
it's
the
also
activists.
Different. Yes, yeah, that was another reason for the term. But I'm just wondering whether non-cosmopolitan adequately describes those local networks, given that the circumstances throw together people who may come from many parts of the world.
Right.
I'm just thinking of an example I came across in Spain. It's illegal for non-documented immigrants to gather in public anywhere. So the only way they can do so is to gather so many people to deter the police from attacking them.
Same thing in many places of the world, right?
Yeah, this is just an example of
That's why the big city matters.
An example of how the attempt to keep people invisible almost forces them into becoming nothing or into becoming rebels in large numbers. So I'm just wondering why you use the word non-cosmopolitan.
Well, I mean, as I said, you know, it is one way of trying to capture something. It is also a way of positioning the argument vis-a-vis a very large crowd of scholars who are basically, in my view, collapsing questions of global politics, a global consciousness, global civil society with cosmopolitanism. What happened in Porto Alegre, what you describe, what happens in the big, that is why I said big cities, where you have this incredible mixity, there is a globality that is getting enacted there. There is an enormous sort of variety of backgrounds and of projects. But why immediately say, okay, then it has to be cosmopolitan? Now, I say non-cosmopolitan partly because I'm contesting the current slew of scholarship and scholars who are what I consider collapsing this issue of, you know, if it's global, if it's mixed, if it's international, it's cosmopolitan. Now, I must say, I have been a bit of a contrarian as a scholar. Everybody was talking about the global economy. I said, all right, show me where it is. And so I wound up with global cities because I don't want to just deal. And in a way, it's the same analytics now, you know, that I am trying if you want, unpack these quick collapses of one category into the other. Now, if there were no scholar talking about cosmopolitanism and, you know, and globality and cosmopolitanism are one and the same in a way, then I would probably not be using the term non-cosmopolitan. If it would have stayed with Kant, etc., and that older, you know, I would not be using the term. Right now, when I say non-cosmopolitan, I immediately am either irritating or pleasing those who are as irritated as I am by this collapse of the global with the cosmopolitan. So that is. But the point that you make, undocumented immigrants, the same thing in the United States. But precisely that is why I said big city, messy, anarchic is important. And the mixity of people. And that is why, yes, it's the global corporations. Yes, yes, it's the financial markets. But it is also this other world of actors that are, in a way, informal actors that the space of the city makes possible. But that mixity, that is not necessarily cosmopolitan. I really think that we need to keep some precision in these terms, and we need to liberate the notion of, you know, what is a politics of the global. It can run through a cosmopolitan, etc., or it can run through these multiple, very, you know, sort of localized projects. That is sort of what I'm... But it is partly a relational use in the sense that I'm dealing with people who are using this term cosmopolitan too much. That's what I'm saying. And they render invisible these other instances. That's a crucial issue there, too.
Yes, thank you for your culture. It was an excellent opportunity to think of things I haven't thought since I finished my master's. So, my question is to go back to the immigrant. To what extent do you think that the culture of the recipient country influences the acceptance of the immigrant and his or her attitude towards this new country? And by that I mean, and I'm drawing on Morley, about ideas of home. And my idea is that the ideas of a homeland are do remain within the immigrant because a new home is being denied to that immigrant. And my right. example through my informal research mind is I noticed Greek immigrants in Northern Europe and the States that they do retain notions of Greekness and identity. Their kids go to Greek schools, they speak Greek. But when I was in Latin America, in Argentina in particular, which has 250,000 Greek immigrants over there, and I met quite a lot of them. Well, they can't even speak Greek.
They were Argentines.
Actually, they have been assimilated because of the acceptance of the Argentinian population.
Yeah.
So, and also, what we also observe in North European capitals, and maybe in the States, I don't know that much about the States, is that a certain hybridization of culture that takes place through this denial towards the immigrants to be assimilated within their
Right. I agree with what you're saying. And just to start with the last point, that is why I said that what I see happening when I talk about these new kinds of politics, these new kinds of political subjects that involve both citizens and non-citizens, I think we're going past multiculturalism. You know, it's not just about all these different, something is mixing up, you know, etc., fuzzy conditions. Hybridity is one way of naming it. It's not always necessarily hybrid. But the other way, I think, the other issue analytically is that each of your Greek, whatever, you know, friends or buddies out there in Buenos Aires or wherever it was, is multiple subjects. There's something of the Greek in it. Second point, I think that one of the tendencies that we're seeing is that, coming back to the home issue, that whereas in the past you had sort of a one-to-one, the immigrant community in London, in Paris, in New York, in Buenos Aires, wherever, to the home country. Today, partly again, because of the internet and all of that, and there's quite a bit of interesting evidence, we have a globalizing of these immigrant networks. So even if you're only three people in Bombay who are Greek, they latch onto some website. And so what you have in my reading is the production of a globalized diaspora that goes beyond the one-to-one. Even though the one-to-one, i.e. your community of residence with your home country of origin or community of origin, may still be the dominant. It will vary. But there is interesting evidence that shows this phenomenon of a globalized, lateralizing multiplication. Finally, your point about the receiving culture. What difference does it make in terms of, you know, I think it makes a difference. I mean, Buenos Aires, I grew up in Buenos Aires. Yeah, there was a period when 80% were immigrants. So forget about national culture. That was before I was there, by the way. But the immigrant cultures, the Gallegos, the Italians, I mean, they all constituted, in a way, the city's culture. So it was a very acute moment. I think Australian cities have had this too, you know, the very acute, very extreme sort of conditions. But now I want to come back to the North Atlantic, to Europe. When Italy began to have immigrants in the 80s and became visible really in the 90s, a very, Laura, what did she call? Laura Balbo. I don't know if people know her. Very, very good thinker, etc., also politician for a while, wrote a book called Possibili Razzismi, Possible Racisms. And her argument was that Italy, given its history, where it had depended on the world to take in Italians, probably would not escape racism as a practice in terms vis-a-vis the newcomers, but it could be a different kind of racism, a milder and softer racism. And that did not happen, by the way. The Italians, you know, they were as racist as your average, whatever. And then she wrote a second book not long after that, sort of concluding her, you know, her account and saying, well, you know what? Our past history, our culture of emigration, etc., didn't have much of an impact. So it varies. Buenos Aires, an immigration city at a time, you know, of its history, different from Italy, an emigration country, etc., etc.
The woman with the microphone.
Thank you.
It's
always funny when we talk about globalization and Africa is never mentioned, but I guess.
Where are you?
I'm just here.
I can't. Ah, there. Yes.
Thank
yes.
You. Well, I'd like to drag your attention to my dear continent, Africa, where I guess fuzzy borders are nowhere more true than in this particular region of West Africa, where there have been constant movement of population over centuries.
Yeah.
Well, the world has been talking now about globalization, and to my opinion, African countries' societies have been living it, actually. But yet it seems that today they are more and more closing their boundaries towards each other. I'll not talk about extreme cases like Rwanda, but I'd like to talk about a country with a record of stability, political and economic, in a way, which literally was set on fire with the concept of ivoirité, that is in Ivory Coast recently, I think a couple of years ago. The micro practice which followed was the killing of hundreds of people there who suddenly were not anymore considered as Ivorians, although they have been living there for generations. Well, most of your debate is about cities with at least a legal framework and a more formalized system,
yeah,
which maybe do not exist in many of our countries. But what do you think are the necessary and fundamental enabling elements which could lead to building a state of denationalization towards a greater sense of cosmopolitanism in
Africa.
Africa?
Well, you know, I prefer not talk about issues and areas where I have not done real research. So I did mention Johannesburg, etc., and I will actually start. When I was in Johannesburg not too long ago, I was living downtown Johannesburg, and one of the conversations and the networks that I wound up talking with was a group of, it was an international conference, so you know, it was one of those situations where you had a crowd of various African countries. And the notion of recovering, making visible actually, the fact that you now have a whole number of cross-border commercial circuits that are sub-Saharan African, that Johannesburg, I mean, a lot of the dominant reading of Johannesburg is finished. And I remember I had this press conference, there were about 20 journalists from the country, etc. And I said, you know, and they were asking, what are we going to do with Johannesburg? I said, you know, I don't know what you're going to do with Johannesburg, but before saying that it is finished, go digging and see what is actually happening. So out of that came a series of conversations, etc. And that there is more cross-border activity. Now, this is very partial, very specialized, very particular. But I do think that cross-border economic activity is important. And a scholar, an African scholar in Benin, is actually doing some very serious research on this, as is Malik Abdul Simone, I don't know who is in BIT, right. So that is one part. I mean, again, the way that I work on this is I unpack it. By now you've understood. So what the governments do with each other, the proclamations, that's one thing. I want to look at the material practices whereby people get connected, people's imaginaries can cross borders, etc. So this kind of sub-Saharan African international set of circuits, which are partly informal, is something that we don't want to totally leave. I mean, it is a form of poverty and a form of all of that, no doubt, but let's not kill it. And so I would say that there are similarly other efforts. The women, you know, I'm going to Uganda. I shouldn't say that. My husband is sitting right here. He's always horrified when I'm traveling all over the world. But to the Women's International Women's African Congress. And again, I have the sense from dealing with these women that they have been very active in these cross-border efforts. Third element, we know from an incredibly interesting scholarship that there is far more management in the cities of Africa happening, I'm talking sub-Saharan Africa, than the observations of big international organizations like the World Bank, etc., may capture. But it's an informal urban management that is happening. Now, I would start by trying to map all of these trends that are cutting across the borders of countries, but are really in the shadow of all these conflicts and, you know, state declarations and all of that. Now, at that other level, we have a new organization in Africa that was just set up a year ago that is trying to help African firms throughout Africa to export, import, etc. You know, that's, again, that is a, you know, an international African organization, but it is involved with very practical issues. And, you know, then there are broader issues of politics. There is a broader project about recovering that leadership right after independence, you know, that was brilliant leadership and that had projects that we that have been forgotten a bit, or at least we in the West have forgotten. So, but I'm interested in recovering the specificities, the materialities, the opportunities, etc., that come out of Africa itself. And as you say, there has been a lot of cross-border history in that in the continent. So this is a very complex issue. I mean, I'm just naming a few.
Prior to the 1914 war, it was possible to travel throughout Europe without a passport.
Yep.
In the late 1940s, one of our foreign ministers, Ernest Bevin, a great nationalist, incidentally, said he would be highly delighted to scrap the whole lot of the passport system. Would you recommend this as an aid towards what you've been suggesting, and probably coupling that with the scrapping of all immigration control?
You know, I am very positively provoked by what you're saying. I think that that should be one of the options we talk about. And I have written a lot about the ways in which our current immigration policy throughout the global north is caught up in a major, and I argue, unsustainable contradiction with these globalization policies, right, where we're trying to, so the we have two borders, institution. The border is an institution, right? We have a border for capital, which facilitates the flow. It's like a conveyor belt. And we have a border for people, which is the opposite, which is a barrier. And one of the ways of beginning to answer your question is, how sustainable is this coexistence of these two regimes? When I'm in the United States, they say, it's all right, no problem, we can do it, until micro incidents occur. Like they wanted to check all the trucks crossing between Tijuana and San Diego. I don't know if you know that, but that's a lot of trucks. To check for what? For undocumented immigrants and drugs. They always put them together. And guess what? The commercial interest said, hell no, you're not going to do it on both sides of the border, because this absolutely paralyzes our traffic. So every now and then you find these micro instances where you see the tensions. Now, for me, another interesting case, I don't know if any of you has lately been looking at the NAFTA treaty, you know, or the GATT, even bigger, where when you look at international trade and services in finance and telecommunications, et cetera, there are several articles that are actually mini immigration clauses that establish the freedom of the professionals in finance and telecommunications, et cetera, in the spirit of international trade and investment in services, to circulate across borders. So you have these mini sites where the system is pushing towards an elimination of this notion of the immigrant. How far that will go, I don't know. A crucial issue is to understand whether if we had open borders, would everybody really want to go to Germany? I just don't believe it. And then again, we have little instances that show it. Polish women who have this option, either they can, and they have facilitated matters, but they didn't want to go for a whole year. They worked as cleaning women. They didn't want to go for a whole year to Germany. They organized themselves. And so they go, each one, 3 months to the same household. But this is a multiplication of instances. A household would have, over the period of a year, 4 Polish women, typically from the same village. Each one just wanted to be 3 months in Berlin. Mind you, great, exciting Berlin. Do the job, make the money, and then go back to their hometowns where they have fully fledged social lives, so to speak. So, and the other question I asked myself in his book, Guests and Aliens, I said, at a time when there were no immigration controls, when states lacked the technical capabilities to control their borders, and now they're a bit defective too, those capabilities, but still, they have them. And you had enormous unequal development in Europe. And the distances were manageable. There are incredibly good dissertations that have teased out with enormous detail. It's not necessarily the most entertaining reading, but it's really interesting. And I work with that material. The fact of the matter is that people left their poorer situations to go get a job in a richer situation when there was no obstacle, only under very specific conditions. You know, it was not a free-for-all. It's not that everybody left the poorer areas and went to the richer areas. And I think that when you look at the patterning of migration flows, you see that. That leads me then, in terms of, now I'm cutting over a lot of, you know, issues here, leads me to, as a comment to you, to say the following. This is a speculation. If we had, in fact, if we lifted a lot of restrictions, we would have more circulation also of low-wage workers, like the Polish women, or the Mexicans who become documented, who then immediately move back to Mexico, because they know that they can just come whenever they want. We would not have a massive move of immigrants. There is pent-up demand. There would be some influx. But it would be in spirit, and going back, return migration is far more significant than we tend to know. You know, except if you're in a war-torn country, that is a totally different matter. So I tend to think that it would be interesting and far less of a massive move, you know, from, quote, poverty to wealth, from the global south to the global north, than our mindset and our policymakers' mindset suggests. Now, I believe in regulation, but I want also global finance to be regulated. Now, I do not believe that the body of the immigrant should be the site for regulatory enforcement of an immigration regime or a cross-border, you know, movement regime. And I have a whole, but that's a whole lecture, all right? How do you have regulation of cross-border flows that does not single out the immigrant as the one who has the burden of it all, that looks at other institutional sites with it? So, you know, there is a complex architecture through which I think one could have such a situation, and it would be very different from what we have today, which is producing death and misery, is brutalizing the receiving countries in some ways. I think that Blunkett's white paper is very problematic. I urge you to read it. This is really bad. So,
right. I also believe in regulation. I'm going to impose a restriction. I see other questions around, but I'm afraid they'll have to be asked upstairs.
Yes.
Can I thank on your behalf Saskia not only for her very provocative lecture, but for the very full way in which she responded to the questions.
Thank you.
And we adjourn to the staff dining room, fifth floor.
Yes.